welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And don't forget, on Monday, I forgot to mention this yesterday, but we're going to actually replay, because we've had a lot of people request this, and so that's one of the primary reasons why we're actually airing it again. What a constitutional president could really do for America. Having somebody in that office that understands the Constitution and is willing to do what's necessary to preserve liberty. Now, I will tell you that the globalist, I mean, that president, we would probably suffer an assassination. Because reality is, the globalists do not take kindly to losing the trillions of dollars and the level of control that they've been able to obtain so far. I mean, we're talking a magnitude, you know, that is so immense that there's just no way they would just willingly let it go through their hands. So, you know, the question is it really worth it or not? Is it really worth actually getting somebody? And is there a person out there that's willing to actually die for liberty as a president? Getting back to the notes on the Constitutional Convention, because we've kind of got a lot to do and I kind of want to go through this. And this is difficult to read with all the abbreviations, especially when Madison talks about himself. And so the next comment up, because we just covered yesterday, Wilson's comments regarding, you know, how secure the system really would be from each other, that, you know, this encroachment consideration is, you know, really nothing to be concerned about. Anyway, Mr. Madison was of the opinion, I can't imagine why he just didn't write, I'm of the opinion, instead of Mr. Madison was of the opinion, that there was one less danger of encroachment from the general government than from the state governments. Two, that the mischief from encroachments would be far less fatal if made by the former than if made by the latter. In other words, if the federal government was to encroach, it would be far less fatal than if the states were to do it. Number one, all the examples of other confederacies prove the greater tendency in such systems to anarchy than to tyranny, to be disobedience of the members than to usurpations of the federal head. Our own experience had fully illustrated this tendency, but it would have been said that the proposed change in the principles and form of the Union would vary the tendency that the general government will have a real and greater powers and will be derived in one branch, at least from the people, not from the governments to the states. To give full force to this objection, let it be supposed for a moment that indefinite power should be given to the general legislature and the states reduced to corporations dependent on the general legislature. Now, that's a little C corporations. Now, because they're just looking at, you know, a united body, not necessarily a corporation that we have in the governments today. And the states reduced, okay, so why should it follow that the general government would take from the states any branch of their power as far as its operations was beneficial and its continuance desirable to the people? In some of the states, particularly in Connecticut, all the townships are incorporated and have a certain limited jurisdiction. Have the representatives of the people of the townships in the legislature of the state ever endeavored to despoil the townships of any part of their local authority? As far as this local authority is convenient to the people, they are attached to it, and their representatives, chosen by amenable to them naturally, respect their attachments to this as much as their attachment to any other right or interest. The relation of a general government to state governments is parallel. Two, guards were more necessary against encroachments of the states on the general government than the latter on the former. The great object made against the abolition of the state governments was that the general government could not extend to care to all the minute objects which fall under the cognizance of the local jurisdiction. The objection, as stated, lay not against the probable abuse of the general power, but against the imperfect use that could be made of it throughout so great an extent of country, and over so great a variety of objects. As far as its operation could be practicable, it could not, in this view, be improper. As far as it would be impracticable, the conveniency of the general government itself would concur with that of the people in maintenance of the subordinate governments. Were it practical for the general government to extend its care to every requisite object without the cooperation of the states, the people would not be less free members of one great republic than as members of 13 small ones. A citizen of Delaware was not more free than a citizen of Virginia, nor would there be more free than a citizen of America, supposing, therefore, a tendency in the general government to absorb the states, no fatal consequence could result, taking the reverse of the supposition that a tendency should be left in the states towards an independence on the general government, and the gloomy consequences not to be pointed out. The imagination of them must have suggested to the states the experiment we are now making to prevent the calamity, and must have formed the chief motive with those present to undertake the arduous task on the one question resolving, quote, that the legislature ought to consist of two branches, close quote. And so now there was a vote before the delegates. Massachusetts agreed. Connecticut agreed. New York said no. New Jersey said no. Pennsylvania agreed. Delaware said no. So it's divided 3-3. Maryland divided. Virginia said yes. North Carolina said yes. South Carolina said yes. And Georgia said yes. So the motion carried. So in other words, they actually, you could actually see what states were aligning. So New Jersey and New York were aligned, and Delaware. Now, Pennsylvania happened to be this outlier, but I mean, if you look at Delaware, its separation is between Pennsylvania and New Jersey, right? Anyway, the third resolution of the report taken into consideration, General Pinckney moved that the first branch, instead of being elected by the people, should be elected in such manner as the legislature of each state should direct. He urged, one, that this liberty would be more satisfaction, as the legislature could then accommodate the mode of the conveniency and opinions of the people. Two, that it would avoid the undue influence of large counties, which would prevail if the elections were to be made in districts as much as the mode intended by the report of the committee. And three, that otherwise disputed elections must be referred to the general legislature, which would be attended with intolerable expense and trouble to the distant parts of the republic. Now, it's kind of interesting because they're kind of going back and forth as to, how these controls of government are and the representation. I find it interesting that there were a lot of men. Now, this was not the prevailing thought, because there was enough that actually ended up to acquiesce in giving people representation. When we read the discussions or the debates in Congress over the Bill of Rights. I've told you this before. Go look at them. We actually have these posted on reclaimingtherepublic.org. It's on the Constitutional Articles page. That's where you're going to find our debates. And if you pull those in, you're going to find that the most contended issue of the Bill of Rights was your right to petition and instruct your public servant. Those guys in Congress did not like it. Now, even though it passed, that was the one thing that was just wrestled to ad nauseum. Those folks that, you know, were debating this, many of them, but not enough, but many of them did not like the idea of protecting your right to petition them for the redress of grievances. They said, you know, anyway, if you need to read those debates, because it is just amazing the paradigm of these people that really they did believe that they were above the common man. And, you know, I know Madison had uttered those same words, but he acquiesced that the necessity needed to be given to them. Mr. Martin seconded the motion of Mr. Pinckney. Now, Colonel Hamilton considered the motion as intended manifestly to transfer the election from the people to the state legislatures, which would essentially wipe out the plan. It would increase the state influence, which could not be too watchful, not be too watchful of a guard against. All too much must admit the possibility in the general government should maintain itself and that the state governments might gradually dwindle into nothing. The system, therefore, should not be engrafted on what might possibly fail. Mr. Mason now urged the necessity of retaining the election by the people. Whatever inconveniency may attend the democratic principle, it must actuate one part of government. It is the only security for the rights of the people. Now, yesterday I kind of alluded to this one point, and I basically said, you know, when we look at the sacred responsibility of preserving our liberty and having that opportunity, it is an indictment when we see people today willing to game the system so that they can take from others to have something that they don't have. In other words, when they can start using the system to basically give to them, that is not preserving their liberty. That is surrendering themselves to the state. And so even though Mason wanted to protect the democracy, he was well aware, because that's what he said. You know, whatever inconveniency may attend the democratic principle, it must actuate one part of the government. It is the only security for the rights of the people. Now, why is it the people aren't protecting their rights anymore? Because they're getting an advantage. People are notorious for gaming the system. As a matter of fact, I'm going to stop right here for just a quick second. And because my wife works in healthcare, and she's worked in the city where the homelessness is just taking big time advantage of the hospitals and healthcare. When they get admitted, my wife came home, she was just infuriated when one of the patients requested, "Hey, can you take my clothes and have them laundered, please?" Like these people are in a hotel and they expect all the food and so forth. In other words, the people that are constantly abusing, because they're not paying a penny for their health care. They're going out and using every dollar that they have. They're stealing, committing crime or what have you, for drugs or what have you. Now, there may be some decent homeless people, but that is the outlier. What they deal with in the hospital are people who are gaming the system in the city. Now, conversely, in a rural context, it is absolutely different. Now that the rural people who are poor enough to where they can't afford health care, They're doing the exact same thing. They're gaming the system for their medication and so forth. But it's not to the same. In other words, they're not actually trying to, get, a warm night in a nice warm bed because it's freezing outside and they're homeless. They're just trying to have and take advantage of free access to doctors. And as we've started creating these portals for, I'll say, the interface between a patient and a doctor, the doctors are actually starting to push back going, hey, I can't bill these hours. I mean, they're giving away their expertise and so forth as they interface with patients that are not billable contacts. In other words, the way the system works is you come in, you sit and, you go through an exam or whatever. That's a billable transaction. And so more and more patients are living in the portal saying, hey, can you give me this? I have an infection, give me that, and so forth. And I'm going, why is it that, regardless of the situation, people take advantage today? What has happened to the mores or, to the character of this nation? That's the underlying problem here. We have lost our hold on enlightenment. We have plunged into, I'd call it debauchery. Most people don't even look at it that way. When you see all these different people, they all don't look bad. But remember, Lot felt the same way in Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, he really felt that there were a lot of good people. And, the Lord challenged him. Hey, go get me 100. Go get me 10. Get me 1. So what we're seeing here and what they're talking about is interesting, how Mason really believed that. But the paradigms shift over time. And so the system, unless you understand the system, those who are in power start to abuse it by convincing you that it's something that it's not. And that's what's happened, because the judges and politicians and lawyers and courts and so forth have all started misleading us that the government can do anything and everything. Folks, if we don't start standing up and using petitions and holding government accountable, we will rue the day. It's that simple. We will rue the day. Now, Mr. Sherman, so Mr. Mason basically just talked about the democratic principle, and it's far better to have that because the people will secure their rights. Mr. Sherman would like an election by the legislature best, but is content with the plan as it stands. Mr. Rutledge could not admit the solidity of the distinction between immediate and immediate election by the people. It was the same thing to act by oneself and to act by another. An election by the legislature would be more refined than an election immediately by the people. In other words, the immediate election as the mediators or as your representatives, he's basically saying it's the same thing and it's probably better. And would be, it's giving people more and more power. The wherever the power sits, people use it as a weapon. That is the common problem with humanity. Any person that obtains some form of power starts using it as a weapon. Now, Mr. Rutledge goes on and says, if this convention had been chosen by the people in districts, it is not to be supposed that such proper characters would have been preferred. The delegates to Congress, he thought, had also been fitter men than would have been appointed by the people at large. Mr. Wilson considered the election of the first branch by the people not only as the cornerstone, but as the foundation of the fabric, and that the difference between a immediate and immediate election was immense. the difference was particularly worthy of notice in this respect, that the legislatures are actuated not merely by the sentiment of the people, but have an official sentiment opposed to that general government and perhaps to that of the people themselves. Now, Mr. King from Massachusetts enlarged on the same distinction. He supposed the legislature would constantly choose men subservient to their own views as contrasted to the general government, and that they might even devise modes of election that would be subversive to end in view. He remarked several instances in which the views of a state might be at variance with those of the general government, and mentioned particularly a competition between the national and state governments, or the national state debts, for the most certain and productive funds. General Pinckney was for making the state governments a part of the general system. So voila, here General Pinckney comes in and says, let's make the state governments administrative pogues for the federal government. If they were to be abolished or lose their agency, South Carolina and other states would have but a small share of the benefit or the benefits of government. On the question for General Pinckney's motion of to substitute the election of the first branch in such a mode as to the legislature should appoint instead of it being elected by the people, Massachusetts, now they actually had a vote. They said, okay, are we going to do it by the people or the state legislature? And Pinckney wanted to do it by the people, or by the legislature. Massachusetts said no. Connecticut said yes. New York said no. New Jersey said no. Pennsylvania said no. Delaware said yes. Maryland was divided. Virginia said no. North Carolina said no. South Carolina. I mean, there were only two states that said yes. New York and New Jersey. New Jersey and Connecticut. And so that failed. The concept, I mean, even though we see all the talk about, you know, we needed the state legislatures to do this, when it came down to the voting and the ultimate decision, this kind of goes to what Professor Lash points out in his article, how the opponents, not the proponents, the opponents actually harangue and they get very loud and they don't surrender. They get somebody else to come in and basically, you know, stonewall, or they get somebody else to, you know, filibuster, just take up the time in saying, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And then when it goes to vote, it's overwhelmingly overthrown, or the concept is not embraced, and they actually, you know, support the real concept that they were claiming that was bad when it actually wasn't bad. With the 14th Amendment, there were lots of negative and disparaging comments from the same men in trying to make the 14th Amendment seem evil. It's the same thing with the Anti-Federalists regarding the Constitution. We have to be very careful when we're reading these words, and it's hard to differentiate at this point because these are Madison's notes, whether these men were friendly, whether they were opponents to the concepts of being presented, or whether they were proponents. And to be honest, I think at this point in time, in this juncture of the convention, men were just trying to feel out and work through all of the different arguments as these ideas were, growing and maturing, evolving, so to speak, into this new form, these new concepts that nobody had ever thought of before. I mean, the creativity exceeds, you know, what anybody could expect, or even more importantly, the end product delivered such a government that has actually been able to secure a land of liberty all of this time. Even though we're living under tyranny today, we still enjoy liberties that are not experienced anywhere else. So with that, we've got this promo, and we will be right back with some more comments.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so the move failed that they were going to make this done by the state legislature instead of by the people, right? And so General Pinckney then moved that the first branch be elected by the people in such a mode as the legislature should direct, but waived it on its being hinted that such a provision might be more properly tried in the detail of the plan. On the question for the election of the first branch by the people, Massachusetts said yes, Connecticut, yes, New Jersey said no, yes by Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland. Again, Maryland seems to constantly be divided, and that's interesting. Virginia, everybody else said yes. So in other words, there was only one dissent, and that was New Jersey. Hey, folks in New Jersey, what the heck? You had delegates that did not want you guys to have a general election for your representatives. Interesting. Anyway, that's at this stage. I mean, again, things were evolving, as I was just saying. Mr. Randolph moved to strike out, quote, 3 years, close quote, and insert 2 years. He was sensible that the annual elections were a source of great mischief in the states, yet it was the want of such checks against popular intemperance as were now proposed. In other words, he wanted to make sure that the people could quickly get rid of a bad representative. That the original design was that these men would be appointed by the legislature, just like the Senate, where there's far less concern of that. Now, we would just want to make sure that the people, if they regret who they elected because they weren't who they said they were, then they could get rid of them quicker. One would think that when they tried to do that with the Senate, they should have changed the Senate's terms in half to 3 years. And I would say that because the people are now, you know, are easily fooled and would basically suffer the consequences. Anyway, going on, he says, the annual elections were a source of great mischief in the states, yet it was the want of such checks against the popular intemperance as were now proposed that rendered them so mischievous. He would have preferred annual to biennial, but for the extent, in other words, once a year instead of every other year, but for the extent of the United States and the inconveniences, in other words, the vast size of the United States and the need to travel those distances, which would result from them to be the representatives of the extreme parts of the empire, the people were attached to frequency of elections. All the constitutions of the states, except that of South Carolina, had established annual elections. So it was more problematic, but they still kept the biennial elections. Mr. Dickinson, the idea of annual elections was borrowed from the antient usage of England, a country much less extensive than ours. He supposed biennial would be inconvenient, but preferred triennial, And in order to prevent the inconveniency of an entire change of the whole number at the same moment, suggested a rotation by annual election of one-third. Now, what Mr. Dickinson just suggested was actually adopted for the Senate, but not for the House of Representatives, because that's exactly what they did. They basically formed the Senate, and then one-third of the senators would be up for re-election in 2 years. The other third would be up for re-election, in 4 years. And then the last third would be up for re-election in 6 years. And I have no idea how they really drew the straws, but they did it in a way to ensure that there was an equal amount of people in each of the thirds, right? I mean, it wouldn't make sense to only have two in one, two in the other, and the rest in the other. The whole point was to maintain continuity so that you couldn't just flush your entire Senate in 1 year. That is exactly what we have the ability to do with the House of Representatives. Flush them all. And we've never done that. We have yet to do that. As a matter of fact, you know, we hear, there have been points in time where leftists have called for that and got those on the right to do it, but the leftists actually kept their people in, and that's how they were able to gain seats. So, I mean, it's like the old, you know, who was the girl? Is it Lucy? It was Lucy and Charlie Brown, right? She'd, you know, coax him into kicking the ball, and she'd lift the ball each time. Anyway, and that's what the left do. They, you know, coax you into believing that they're going to be honest in what they're talking about, and then they actually prove that they're dishonest. Anyway, Mr. Ellsworth was opposed to 3 years, supposing that even 1 year was preferable to two. The people were fond of frequent elections and might be safely indulged in one branch of the legislature. He moved for 1 year. Now, it was seconded by Mr. Strong. Now, let's look at it this way. What happens when you have to go into an election every year for your public servants? In these days, these men had to pay a poll tax. I honestly believe that what we were probably looking at was an opportunity for the state to make money on property taxes, because that was the only time you had to pay your property tax. Now, property tax was not compulsory. It was only a requirement if you wanted to engage in government. In other words, you didn't suffer from property tax if you never wanted to vote. If you wanted to participate in the government, then you paid a property tax or a poll tax, basically the same. Mr. Strong seconded the support and the motion. Mr. Wilson being for making the first branch an effectual representation of the people at large, preferred an annual election of it. This frequency was most familiar and pleasing to the people. It would not be more inconvenient to them than triennial elections, as the people in all states have annual meetings with which the election of the national representative might be made to coincide. He did not conceive that it would be necessary for the national legislature to sit constantly, perhaps not half, perhaps not one-fourth of the year. In other words, that they wouldn't need, because what are they going to do? They don't control every aspect of our lives. Congress didn't need, he was basically saying maybe one-fourth of the year they would actually be serving in office. Now, this is where we finally get to the electors. Mr. Madison was persuaded that the annual elections would be extremely inconvenient and apprehensive that the biennial would be too much. He did not mean inconvenient to the electors. Now, he's talking about the voters, but to the representatives. They would have to travel 700 or 800 miles from the distant parts of the Union and would probably not be allowed even a reimbursement of their expense. Besides, none of those who wish to be reelected would remain at the seat of government, confiding that their absence would not affect them, the members of Congress had done this with few instances of disappointment. But as the choice was here to be made by the people themselves, who would be much less complacent to individuals and much more susceptible of the impression from the presence of a rival candidate, it must be supposed that the members of the most distant states would travel backwards and forwards at least as often as elections should be repeated. Much was to be said also also on the time requisite for new members who would also form a large population to acquire that knowledge of the affairs of the state in general, without which their trust could not be usefully discharged. Now, Mr. Sherman, so they're just talking about the elections of the representatives of the people going back and forth. Mr. Sherman preferred annual elections, but would be content with biennial. He thought that the representative ought to return home and mix with the people. By remaining at the seat of government, they would acquire the habits of the place, which might differ from those of their constituents. Now, Colonel Mason observed that the states being differently situated, such a rule ought to be formed as would put them as nearly as possible on a level. If elections were annual, the middle states would have a great advantage over the extreme ones. He wished that the biennial and the rathers in that case would coincide with the periodical elections of South Carolina as well as the other states. Now, Mr. Hamilton urged the necessity of 3 years that ought to be neither too much or too little dependence on the popular sentiments. The checks on the other branch of government would be not feeble, and would not every auxiliary principle that could be interwoven. The British House of Commons, now, because the House of Commons is very similar because it was elected by the people, supposedly, were elected septennial, yet the democratic spirit of these in the Constitution had not ceased. Frequency of elections tended to make the people listless to them, and to facilitate the success of little cabals. This evil was complained of in all the states. In Virginia, it had been lately found necessary to force the attendance and voting of the people by severe regulations. One of the questions for striking out 3 years, Massachusetts, so in other words, basically the motion carried that it went on for 2 years without any dissent. Now, what we're looking at is really how they just yammered back and forth. And what we're going to do next is we're actually going to go and dive into the Electoral College and some of these other, I'll just say, essential matters that really started, you know, coming up. Now, I've got one that I've kind of highlighted. Now, this is Mr. Wilson, and this is the concept of electors, not the voters, but the actual Electoral College. And so what this does is it kind of highlights, you know, how this started to begin forming. This was June 25th. In other words, a month later, they actually started diving into this, you know, concept of electors and so forth. And it wasn't until much later that they really dove and dove and dove. They kept on revisiting the process of choosing the president. So this is the last piece I want to read until we come back to this after the presidential, a constitutional presidential advantage. If we elected a president that actually understood the Constitution, what kind of difference would that really make? So we're going to be airing that on Monday. And so we'll come back to, Paul and I will come back to these notes on Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. As a matter of fact, if you do not have a copy of Madison, the book, not the notes here, but Madison's book on his observations of the Constitutional Convention, as a matter of fact, I know I have it, And so let me actually pull it up because I want to give you the title. Because what we can do is we can actually post this. And let me see here. Do I have it? It is, I believe, in my references. And so congressional record. Well, I got to go find it. I know I've actually copied it down because what Madison did was Madison published this book and he actually filled in a lot of the blanks. The reason and what I'd like to do, because I've never done this before, I'd actually like to compare what he wrote in the notes and then how he expounded and explained it later. Because as we look at the notes on the Constitutional Convention, they're kind of wordy and it's 466 pages, folks. When I look at Madison's published book, it may be 600 pages, but that's trimmed down to a much smaller page instead of, you know, 8.5 by 11. Back in those days, they didn't have standard prints, you know, 8.5 by 11 as a standard piece of paper. Anyway, so the reason I'm bringing this up is in my research and looking at this, you could actually, you know, hear people credit Madison's expounding on his notes in his book as more insightful than the notes themselves. I look at the notes as raw facts that were being captured by Madison in his endeavor to kind of keep track of everything that was going on. When Madison published the book, I think this is where he had more of a filtering process. It's not that he didn't write his notes within his biases, right? Because, you know, Paul and I have kind of talked about this. You can kind of tell that he had some biases, but I think those biases were probably more prevalent in his notes and looking at things the way he did. Now, in my observation, out of everybody, out of the framers' days, who actually spoke of these very specific issues of what happened here, what happened there, over the course of their lifetime, Madison was the most consistent in holding to the principles of how he basically said, you know, this is how it happened. And he was consistent all the time. Like when we look at the Kentucky resolutions, the Virginia resolutions, then we look at the report, and then we look 30 some years later, how Madison explained those exact same things later, he was very consistent. So, I mean, anybody that has ever dealt with a perpetual or a habitual liar will realize that, you know, the story changes and it adapts to the narrative that the liar is trying to portray at that point in time, wanting you to think a certain way. And so when we look at Hamilton during the Federalist Papers and then during the ratification debates and then post the ratification debates while he was the Secretary of Treasury and while he was, you know, intermingling politically with the political class of the federal government and state government, you could clearly see Hamilton had donned a different costume based on the audience, which is one of the reasons why I look at this guy as a true character that wasn't there to serve, you know, the truth or, you know, to serve the people the truth. It was more of a agenda that he was trying to accomplish, which to me makes, you know, after McKibben's and, you know, the leader group kind of told, you know, or gave me the information that there is this strong evidence that Hamilton was a spy. Okay, so that starts to make sense why he was such a scoundrel and inconsistent in how he recounted over the course of time what happened at the Constitutional Convention, what happened in the ratification debates, the Federalist Papers, so forth and so on. I mean, he literally changed his costumes. Now, Mr. Wilson talks about the electors, and he says, the question is, shall the members of the second branch be chosen by the legislatures of the states? When he considered the amazing extent of the country, the immense population, which it is, let me make sure I've got the right spot here. Yes, so this is Mr. Wilson, like I said. The question of the immensity of the population, which is to fill in the influence which the government we are to form will have not the only the present generation of our people and their multiplied prosperity, but on the whole globe, he was lost in the magnitude of the object. The project of Henry IV, his statesman, was but the picture in a miniature of the great portrait to be exhibited. He was opposed to an election by the state legislatures. In explaining his reason, it was necessary to observe the twofold relationship in which the people would stand, one, as citizens of the general government, and two, as citizens of their particular state. In other words, we, the citizens, have these two separate roles. And actually, if you really look at it, you're a citizen of your county, a citizen of your state, and then a citizen of the nation, or, you know, the general government. The general government was meant for them in the first capacity, the state government in the second. Both governments were derived from the people, both meant for the people, both, therefore, ought to be regulated on the same principles. The same train of ideas which belong to the relation of the citizens of the state governments were applicable to the relation to the general government, and in forming the latter, we ought to proceed by abstracting as much possible from an idea, state government with respects to the providence or the province and objects of the general government. They should be considered as having no existence. The election of the second branch by the legislature would introduce and cherish local interests and local prejudices. The general government is not an assemblage of states, but an individual for certain political purposes. It is not meant for the states, but for the individual composing them. The individuals, therefore, not the states, ought to be represented in it. A proportion in this representation can be preserved in the second as well as the first branch, and the election made by electors chosen by the people for that purpose. He moved to an amendment to that effect, which was not seconded. So, in other words, he actually came down with this idea. This is the first showing of these electors of choosing somebody for the people. In this concept of that the people would actually choose the electors. It was proposed, remember, it was proposed by Randolph, that the electors would actually be chosen from the first government, in other words, the House of Representatives would choose the Senate, and then I believe the House of Representatives would also choose the electors who would then choose the president in Randolph's plan. I believe I got that right. And so Mr. Wilson felt that the people should choose their electors as well as choosing their representatives. And this was the first time I think this concept started breaking out. As I remember in reading W. Cleon Skousen, who kind of went through and he scoured the notes on the Constitutional Convention and a lot of documents, I believe that there were 60, if not more, individual votes and measures, you know, motions and this to do this, to do this, over the Electoral College and the choosing of the president. When I say that this concept of the choosing of the president was one of the most complex or one of the most heavily debated issues of the Constitution, Not that slavery wasn't one of the hottest issues debated, but in trying to derive a government, in trying to derive a system that prevented a direct election, with prevented the perception that the people had a supreme ruler, in other words, a mandate by the people, that by creating this intercession, or I should say by creating this layer of wise men to choose the president, nowhere in the Constitution, and when we go through these debates or this constitutional convention, and when we go through the ratification debates, because we're going to cover this year, nowhere are we going to find where it was the accepted idea that the state legislatures could dictate the outcome of the electors. In other words, they could hand them to the party for the party to choose who they wanted to become the president of the United States. The concept was clear, and we're going to go through this, that you, the people, were to, you know, run as electors, and you, the people, were to choose who would be your elector in choosing both the president and the vice president. I want to make sure you just understood what I said, that the electors chose who that ticket was. It wasn't up to the candidates to say, you're going to be my vice president, and this is the ticket, like it or not. The electors would decide who would be best suited as president and who would be best suited as vice president, maybe creating contrast or complementary alignments. It was up to them. And they were to choose. And if they couldn't choose, then it would actually go to Congress, where the House of Representatives, in quorum, in other words, as a whole state, the state would have one vote. They would choose who was going to be their president. And it would be out of, as if you go through the constitutional process, they would trim it down to no greater than three, but they would have to have whoever had the greatest vote. In other words, the Electoral College, and having a mandate of 270, you'd only need 26 states to choose a president via the 12th Amendment. You don't have to have a supermajority or anything else. And what would have ended up happening in 2020, had Pence not committed treason, had Congress not committed treason, and had they followed the Constitution, Biden would never have been selected or chosen. Nobody was actually selected or chosen constitutionally. The fact that Congress allowed the state, or I should say, the Electoral College to choose the president when it was unconstitutionally formed was an abomination. But the fact is, our Electoral College has become an abomination because the party seized control in 1856. Folks, all of this stuff is really important in diving into this so that you kind of understand this. We're here to help. We're not from the government. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.